Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
I'm brilliant.
Yes, why? Why are you brilliant today?
Because today we have a guest that I care a lot about.
Oh, yeah.
I love his art.
Oh, yes.
And I've also had the great privilege of working with him a number of times for Counter Editions.
Okay.
And this incredible artist began work in the 1970s and is best known for collages and photographic kind of appropriation.
Can we call him the king of collage?
Well, I think you can, actually.
Great.
Because he's literally been making collages since he was probably in his late teens or something, which we will discover. And now at the age of, I think, 70 maybe, is literally changing the world with his collages. And people are super excited to be showing him in biennales. Mm-hmm. He even won the Deutsche Börse Prize, the photography prize in 2015, which is a big accolade. I'm basically a huge fan. So
me too.
We would like to welcome
John Stesica. Hi, John. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. After that, I feel absolutely wonderful, of course. What an introduction. I didn't expect that at all.
But you
that seems
feel
to
wonderful.
Be a running theme on this podcast. People are like crying like, by the time they
the
start
intros.
Talking.
Yeah.
I think this is
your life.
I've also realised I'm a bit way too over-enthusiastic.
No, and, never.
I know. I don't know if you can.
Never apologise for enthusiasm.
Okay, good.
Absolutely, I agree with that.
Yes.
You can't actually. The hyperbole is never too excessive.
Well, the thing is, I actually mean it.
Hyperbole, not hyperbole. How do you say it?
Hyperbole.
I'm afraid it is called, I believe.
Oh, I've always read it as hyperbole.
Yeah.
Hyperbole, yeah.
Well, it's changed my life already.
Yeah, absolutely.
There we go.
So just before this interview, John said to me that he might not be doing that many public appearances in the future. So I'm really happy that we're getting this exclusive, incredible interview with John.
Yes, thank you.
Well, yeah, it was just a decision I made recently. I just thought, I keep giving lectures wherever I do, you know, shows. And essentially, I say much the same thing, sometimes with a different kind of work, but, you know, much the same thing. I thought, why am I wasting my time?
Yeah.
Because it's out there. I mean, I know people see it on the computer and things.
Mm.
So I know it's around. You don't really need me to reiterate this.
It's
the whole
like
time.
You have your sound bites and your gobbets down, and
absolutely,
then you've got your regurgitating them.
So I thought I might dedicate myself a bit more to doing some writing and thinking about what I'm doing.
Oh, nice.
That's great.
Instead of all these public appearances.
Well, we're trying to ask you some off-centre questions today, then. Okay. So there's going to be new information out there in the world. Well, first of all, you get most of your art from found images. You find a lot of images in junk shops and bookstores and, you know, thrift markets and everything.
But even like film memorabilia fairs, no?
Yes, I get all those things. I mean, junk shops and ordinary shops, I'm finding more and more difficult to source material these days. And so, like everyone, I'm buying stuff online, which means
eBay?
Yeah.
Yes, eBay's a life changer.
Absolutely.
What do you search for?
Well, it depends. I mean, actually, what I tend to do is I look for commercial. I mean, the biggest collection of images I have are film stills, as you probably know, and film, you know, portraits of film stars. And I have a number of people around the world who kind of source these from various collections. But the first thing I do when I hear about a commercial collection is I ask them if they have any unwanted material. And that means usually images of actors and actresses that are either unknown or forgotten or whatever, or sometimes never even made a film. And the other category of unwanted material tends to be damaged stuff.
Mm.
And both of these are extremely valuable to me. I love damage to begin with because it's already kind of slightly cut up. It kind of gives me the excuse for cutting. And anonymous actors are more useful than well-known ones because I have to do less to disguise who they are. Because my work's all about seeing the image outside a kind of sense of its legibility or ordinary meaning. So I have to disassociate it from a persona or actor or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
It needs to be rendered unrecognisable. So I tend to get these cardboard boxes arriving through the post just full of stuff that you know, collectors can't wait to get rid of material they don't
so
want.
Yeah, of course. Because they all want the Marilyn Monroe or the
right.
superstar, yeah, like no, James Dean or something.
Yeah, with the shortage of material, film still material, I've now bought the stock from two entire shops. Well, one shop and one huge film collection.
Do you feel guilty when you... I mean, you said the damaged ones makes it easier to kind of cut up.
Yeah.
Do you feel guilty about these kind of pieces of history, historical documents that you're splicing?
Absolutely.
You do?
I do feel terrible sometimes, yes. and that's why the last big collection of film stills... Really, when I bought a shop... I'll tell you the story, which is quite funny.
Yeah, go on.
Story. For years and years, I went around various shops collecting film stills, and I'd be a classic time waster in these shops, you know. I'd go in and come out with 2 10-by-8s and leave.
And you've been in there like 3 or 4 hours.
That's right. and then gradually, as the various shops that I used to go to closed down, you'd find the stock from one in the other until there was just one. And it was called Flashbacks in Soho. And I thought it would be there forever somehow. I kept going. Whenever I had a day off from teaching or whatever, I'd pop in.
They'd know you, obviously. They'd be like, hi, John. Yeah. Right, here he is. Yes. He's back.
Yes. The tinkle of the bell as I go in, all that sort of thing. Anyway, one day I went there. The shop was empty. There was just some bits of paper on the floor.
No.
Oh.
I nearly had a heart attack. I thought, oh my God, career over. End of, you know. I went home. I composed myself sufficiently to phone the old number. And to my surprise, I got through to them, a familiar voice. They knew who I was, and they said, "Oh, I'm sorry. We've had to move to an industrial unit.
Oh, wow!
Out in the East End. But you're welcome. We're now only selling online, but as a time honoured
loyal
waster.
Yeah, yeah.
You can come and waste our time out there if you like." So I went out there, and for the first time, I could actually see what used to be tucked away in these kind of dark basements. And
oh, wow! Thing.
It was all out in cardboard boxes, and there was one box marked damaged. And
ding, ding, ding.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All the lights lit
so
up in your brain.
I looked through the material, and I thought, oh, wow. I tried not to look too excited. And I said, how much do you want for that box? And they gave me the most ridiculous price. And before they changed their mind, I just took it. And
how much?
I can't actually remember, but it must have been probably a box of, say, 400 maybe images. Probably for about £30 or £40.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah, nothing.
Wow.
Yeah, nothing.
And were some of them so damaged you couldn't use them, or can you always find a way?
Oh, I can always find a way.
Do you?
Well, no. I mean, there's nothing that's too damaged.
Yeah, great.
Anyway, so I got it home and actually made a lot of... I felt with this abundance of material, it freed me up. And I actually did the main body of what I call the marriage series from that one
really?
Cardboard box.
Wow.
And so, anyway, I decided to go back and have a look some more. And they said, really, we're not doing much with all this film, these film stills. The only thing we're selling, really, are the big film posters.
Mm-hmm.
These are, that's a lot. And they were clearly kind of running the whole business down. The man and wanted to retire, you could tell. And so I just made some money out of some of my collages, and actually some of the ones that I'd sourced there. And so I bought the entire shop's worth of...
No, that's so cool.
And I thought, brilliant. I even said to my assistant that we'd have a little bell on the door so that I can just pretend I'm going into the shop.
Oh.
We kept it exactly as it was, the same filing system, everything, on the wall of my studio down in the basement.
I was going to say, because I've been to your studio a few times. We live very close to each other, actually. And
in your house, is it?
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I love so much about it, is that you get this real sense of you kind of making these collages on a table or in the house almost. There's something so directly, with your hand.
Mm.
And it's so personal. But I love the way that you've got so many like files and drawers and it's like you know where everything is as well. It's like
I don't. No, really.
You don't have an encyclopedic.
Well, anyway, when I've been there, you've always found things that we're trying to.
Yeah.
Look,
oh, yeah, yeah.
But maybe you've already got
that's
them
pieces.
Ready.
That's pieces.
Pieces.
Yeah. Okay. Although I can find pieces. No, but anyway, we installed them exactly as they were in the shop. With the same filing system in alphabetical order according to actor and film. And so you can find anything in there. Anyway, when I started to think about what I had there, I thought, I can't use this material. It's just too perfect. This is a thing in its own right. It needs to be preserved.
Right.
So I decided not to use anything. So I've just not even looked at it. I've just kept it there.
Wow.
Which is really strange.
As a kind of historical...
Occasionally, people come in and they're curious and they look up a particular actor or do exactly what I used to do, you know, like look through films. And,
yeah. Would you ever use it as an installation then, like a...
I have kind of used it, but I've used it to make my films.
Got it. Yes. And your films just flicker through images.
Yeah,
and one's called Blind, isn't it? You don't have enough time to...
Absolutely.
Unless you pause it to know what it is. It's like images... rushing across your eyes.
Well, that was the first. I bought, that was, I can't remember how many thousand, but then when I won the Deutsche Börse Prize, I used the prize money to buy something that was 10 times that size. It's now in my studio down in St. Leonard's.
Wow.
And I have been going through the boxes there for, well, I can't remember how many years it is since I won the prize, but for that many, I'm still only halfway through looking through the material that I bought.
Wow, that's exciting.
But the beauty of this one is that everything in it is in triplicate, at least, sometimes five copies of each.
Wow.
Which means I can use it and preserve it simultaneously.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, nice.
So that's how I get around it. Sorry, it was a very long answer to
your
original question.
It was fantastic. Well, I just want to clear up. So the marriage series, which we were talking about earlier, that exactly, for people that don't know, that is when you take these Hollywood headshots of men and women, isn't it? It's normally men and women, and then you splice them and then you put them together, and so you're playing with gender, what you perceive as gender, and you don't know who is more dominant, the woman or the man, but yet it creates this otherworldly human, basically, right?
You've got it right. For me, it's the creation of personae, really. I mean, persona means mask, I know, but... of people, my feeling is that the criteria that seems to make them work for me is when I feel a sense of love or tenderness towards them and empathy with them. And you don't feel that with the originals, these screen shots. You must have them of yourself, presumably.
I don't keep them around, but yeah, my agent has, and I think my mum's got lots. Yeah.
Well. Whatever. but it's probably kind of, they're probably quite bland images. But somehow, when you splice them together, like Frankenstein.
Yes.
The dead, you know, the
monster.
The dead body parts brought together to create this monster.
Yeah.
But somehow the monster's got some, commands empathy, doesn't it? I mean, in a way, because it's a mutant. It's been pulled together. It's been constructed. And yet, strangely, in that kind of tension between the two sides of the face, there's an aperture, a way in which we as subjects can kind of enter and identify. We want to heal that division somehow. And we, in
scar.
Our own minds and create that persona. And we don't get that from the originals at all. But
you always feel empathy for them. And is it because these guys never really quite made it? So there's quite a tragic sadness about these wannabe performers.
I read that they're called virgins.
So, that's a term I got from one of the shops. Where they collect things. If you've got an actor who's not made a film, a portrait of an actor who has not made a film, then they refer to them as virgins. They're valueless as images, far as collecting it goes. So if you've got at one end of the scale in terms of value, Greta Garbo or Marilyn Monroe, the other is the virgins, yes.
And you like to collect virgins, John?
I do.
Lovely.
I do.
That's amazing. How much was the prize, can we ask? What is that? Is that a publicly known...
I don't think I can remember. I think it was about 30,000.
Well, that's quite nice.
But tax-free.
Oh, really? Mm.
And it was quite interesting at the time because that prize is for photographers. And even though you don't physically take the photo... Well, you do sometimes, but you don't generally in your collages, they're found images. But you won this photography prize, which I thought was so genius because it was such a it was a great thing for them to include you, really. And I think you are a photographer in a sense, because you've been dedicating your life for so many years to photography and found images. Mm. And then you create these new images, which are like composing a photograph in a way. So was there a lot of controversy at the time, or was it?
No, there was. I mean, funnily enough, a lot of the press seemed to kind of think I was going to win it.
Really?
Well, yeah. Yeah. Pretty.
You polled pretty high there.
Yeah, I did. I think there were odds being best betting odds.
Right.
Oh, well, next time, let us know.
So I was getting more and more terrified. I didn't want to win it, to be honest. But mainly because I have this fear of acceptance speeches.
Oh, fair enough, yeah.
I can't bear speeches.
But what was your speech like?
It was okay, but it was well rehearsed.
Oh, right.
By the time it came up, I knew I was going to get it. But there was one critic, and I really like this guy, who said that I shouldn't get it because it really should be reserved for photographers. And I totally agreed with him. It should have been reserved. But I couldn't choose. I did say to the press at the time, not my fault, because it's not as though I put myself up for this prize. Yes. The prize is actually for my show at the Whitechapel.
So yes, yes, yes.
The Whitechapel gets some benefit from it as well. So mm-hmm. I couldn't turn it down as a result. Mm-hmm. But, of course, the money was very handy too.
Yeah, it's great.
Of course, you've got your new film machine. For your, yes, yes, yes. And so the postcards is another... Postcards, vintage postcards is a huge element of your work. And where do you find your postcards? Is it the same sort of...
It used to be the junk shops. More like these days, I go to a hotel in centre of London where they have a regular postcard fair.
Oh, wow.
Oh, right.
But then I have got favourite shops. There's a shop in St Leonard's I've just skipped. Actually, I thought I couldn't find anything in London any longer. And when I moved my studio down to St Leonard's and Hastings, I discovered there's an abundance of just the sort of shops. Well, you know, even film stills. You can buy anything down there.
That's great.
Every shop seems to be a second-hand shop. And one of my favourites is Robert Rummage in the old town in Hastings.
Oh, that's going to get rampaged now. You're going to lose everything.
Yeah. And he has the most amazing collection of postcards at very reasonable price.
And what do you look for in the postcards? Because a lot of them are caves and train tracks and open spaces that create this... When they're placed on top of these characters' faces, you feel like you're seeing the interior workings of these people.
Yeah, that's they are... You've nailed it. I am looking, in general, for... what you might call physical metaphors for interiority, caves. Bachelard, the philosopher, in his Poetics of Space, described certain spaces as being particularly resonant for reverie, dreaming. And he described them as partially enclosed spaces, like caves or forests. Mm. You're in the open, but also enclosed simultaneously. And it's those kind of spaces that I find that I'm attracted to, really. Valleys, creeks, waterfalls, fissures, caves, forests, ruins as well. That's another one.
Yeah. And this series you're talking about is called Masks. And that was the first series I ever saw of your work in the kind of maybe about 2004 or something.
Yeah.
And same with Russell. We were talking about it earlier, actually. And I think that series just, I'd never seen anything like it. And it was just this profound... impact you have from such flat imagery that then becomes so deep, you know, in perspective and
well, you project so much onto these works that you feel like these people you're seeing inside their souls in a kind of way.
Hmm.
Yeah, you like that?
Kind of. That slightly worries me too.
Why? Why does it worry you?
I suppose it's kind of a literal. Yeah, maybe you're right. I don't know. I'm not sure. You see, I'm not sure what I'm doing with these things a lot of the time. I found there are a lot of what I do is to do with hiding things. And I think when you hide something, there is something intriguing about what's been hidden. You want to see behind it. You want to know what's hidden.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast. And we're here today with Budweiser beer. And we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake.
And if you think about it, the earliest art that we know of, Paleolithic cave painting, there is a representation of masks in it. There's a masked figure in Lascaux. So we know that masks pre-exist, and it's pretty obvious they should pre-exist. Probably the most ancient form of art is to put a mask on. And the function of a mask is to hide the person. Mm. So actors, in the days before you were an actor, many, many thousands of years ago, had to wear a mask because they were becoming gods in that process. By putting on the mask,
like the back eye,
they ceased. They ceased to be themselves, the regular person that everyone knows.
Yes,
you know who you are.
Yes,
but with the mask on, that frees them to become something else.
Got it.
Wow.
And that's why I think Greek drama started with the mask drama, because it came out of that tradition. And it's the most ancient. So there is a point at which painting, and drama, and music, and poetry, and was all one thing, and it was based on very, very simple thing, hiding. To hide yourself as an individual, to become a god.
Right, so the postcard itself is a mask.
Yeah.
That is like placing a mask over your face and then disguising yourself. Ah, and then you become this character.
Absolutely.
That's
lovely.
So cool.
Thank you very much for that. That's nice. And so surrealism plays a massive part in your art.
Yes, yes. In a way, it does. I was part of that generation of artists who kind of discovered what was called appropriation. It's not a term I like, appropriation, because it implies a sort of mastery over the material, whereas I feel more submissive towards it. But I felt a lot of my American colleagues, Richard Prince and Cindy Sherman and those people, I think they were relating what they were doing to a kind of tradition of pop and so on. Whereas as a European, I felt closer proximity to surrealism, but it was a very taboo thing at that time. I mean, in the 70s, 80s, early 80s, surrealism was the stuff of cigarette advertising. It was right. Saatchi and Saatchi on right. billboards, and it had a kind of
post-Dali.
Yeah, and Dali was probably the most debased of all.
Yeah, you know?
It was a very difficult thing to be interested in surrealism at that point, and actually, it was really one of the reasons I felt I needed to drop out completely, because no one was really could take anybody seriously who was interested in surrealism at that point. But I wouldn't say that surrealism has been an enduring interest. It certainly sparked off my original collages when I was a student. And later it was an inspiration. Magritte in particular.
Yes.
But it's not something I go back to very often these days. I'm much more interested, for example, in symbolism, Belgian symbolism, for example, which a lot of surrealism came out of.
Who's a famous Belgian symbolist? I'm just thinking of Tintin. That's all I can think of, Hergé.
Love Tintin.
That's all I'm thinking of.
Talking about your early collages, didn't you recently just discover a lot of your early work that then got shown in the Approach Show Love last year? Is
yes.
that right?
Yeah. Yes.
Because I loved that idea that you had all these photographs of your work from when you were a student.
Yeah.
And then you thought it had been lost. Mm. And then you actually found it recently.
Yes. Sadly, my mother died and I was going through the attic and found a whole lot of material, yeah.
Yeah. And what was that like to see the work after all this time?
I thought it had all been damaged. You know, we had a flood in my studio, and I assumed all of it.
You should have loved it then.
Hmm?
It was damaged.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Actually, the thing is that if I'd realised, I could have saved a lot of that material, but I just threw it away at the time. But anyway, we found some old stuff, so it was good. Mm. Mm.
Do you feel like your work is, you can see the thread from there to where you are now, and or was some of it quite similar to
yeah,
where you are
I
now?
Mean, yeah, I think so. I think the early photo romans are very much collages are very much the beginnings of what I've ended up doing, very exploratory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you ever got in trouble copyright infringements?
No, I haven't. I'm touching wood.
I touch it as well. Yeah.
I remember when I first discovered your work, every single artist I met would mention you. And this is kind of like maybe 2002 until 2005. I would go for studio visits with people. I was really interested in Sarah Jones's work and Anne Hardy and Gillian Waring, a lot of Maureen Paley's photographers. And all of them would be like, have you seen John Stesica's work? And you were just being kind of discovered at that point.
Mm.
And you'd been making work for so long before that. And I'm really interested in this idea that you were teaching for a long, long time and the influence you had. And even I used to work with an Armando Andrade Tudela, who's from Peru, and he studied at the Royal College of Art, and his collages were one of my favourite things he did. And then he was there at the Royal College when you were there, and Harris Epinonda, and all these amazing artists who work with collage. And for me and Russell, we both love works on paper. Mm. We always love drawings and collages, and we collected a lot of that as young people. Mm. So when I discovered your work, it was just so exciting. Because
I think it was around 2011, wasn't it? The Whitechapel show.
Yeah, that was
even, when
yeah.
it really happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You'd been with the Approach before.
Since 2004, I think, was my first show.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And that time, I remember people being so excited because
it was
a discovery.
Yeah.
What was it like for you, having been a teacher and then seeing the impact you've had on those artists and then also then having your own successful career?
It was odd, really. I mean, I made the decision way back, really, that I wasn't going to sit around and stand around at openings in galleries hoping that somebody was going to ask to come and do a studio visit. It just felt demeaning. I thought, you know, and nobody seemed to get what I was doing anyway. So I thought it would be best if I just taught and produced the work in my spare time, which is what I did for years, which is why I work mainly at night still. It's because it's the time when, you know, when I finished work, and I still, the habits lived on beyond its necessity.
You still teach now, right?
No. I haven't taught now for 15 years.
Oh, right. But that's your body clock is telling you this is time to work now?
Weirdly, yeah. As soon as my assistant goes home, 6 o'clock is when creativity starts.
Right,
it's
wow.
really bizarre. I've got plenty to do in the day as well, you know, ordinary everyday activities.
Got it.
Needed, but the creative stuff tends to happen at night. And then, I don't know, I suppose gave up. Occasionally, people would remember me and say, include me in some little group show somewhere. So it wasn't as though I was completely off the map, but for the most part, I was. And when I did appear, people seemed bemused by what I was doing, and so it was difficult. Even when I got press, you know, support from
critically,
no one seemed to know quite how to describe it, and it was always the same thing: surrealism or whatever. But anyway, it was usually a put-down surrealist was the kind of way of being put down. And then I don't know. I don't know what it was, and it's really bizarre. I'm still musing on what happened in that moment at the beginning of the millennium. One part of me says that's when I became a father, and that somehow my son brought me good luck. But
wow, oh,
but also
nice.
Another part of me also said that that was actually the worst time for me because I was the main carer for a while, and I couldn't really do my work. I was having to teach and look after my son, and that gap created a kind of a sort of tension. Thought. I don't know. It made me reevaluate. I did think for a moment maybe I should give up altogether. But weirdly, the very moment that I thought of giving up was when the telephone started ringing.
It's amazing.
And I thought, what's going on here? Recently, somebody said to me, well, your work is completely anti-digital, and yet it seems to emerge with digital culture.
Exactly.
And that's an interesting thought.
It is, yeah.
And I do think it has a lot to do with timing and the fact that society and everyone's way of looking at things was ready to accept it somehow. Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah, because I'm completely phobic about, well, actually, I have finally got myself an iPad and an iPhone and all the rest of it. Unfortunately, I'm feeling really bad about it. I did resist for nearly over 10 years having any contact with that.
You didn't have an email? You didn't?
Well, I do, but my assistant would deal with it.
Got it.
Yeah. So I didn't touch the machine myself.
Got it. Yeah.
But it was hypocritical. I began to realise, I mean, I was using eBay, I was using... You know,
yeah.
It had a profound impact on my work, digital culture. And but I did find that an interesting thought, that even though everyone seemed to see me as a sort of refreshing alternative to digital culture, that it could also be seen as a response to digital culture, the sort of things that I'm doing.
Yeah.
And actually, we were talking in the taxi on the way here about your new show. You're doing a group show. You've co-curated it with somebody about trees called Arboretum in St. Leonard's, the first iteration of it. And you were talking about this idea of why people are painting trees or photographing trees or thinking about trees within art. And maybe it has to do with this idea of stillness. And there's definitely something of stillness within your work that I think... It's sort of, when I look at your work, it's almost like a yearning or something. I can't quite explain it, but it's like the psychological, because there is such peace in your work. And also the way that when you slice the eyes in those, I think they're called love, those works, where you have like the three repeated eyes, cut up. There's something so kind of arresting about that idea of looking. And our culture is so much about looking at each other and not just to do with attraction, but to do with all kinds of, the way you interact with the world. And I think it's become increasingly more so because of the development of Instagram, of all of this way we communicate now. And when I look at those images and the eyes are repeated, it sort of just suddenly makes you stop. And you're like,
that work
power
it out.
Of looking.
It's not, because we're so quick, so you want to get the image and you put it in your head and you move on. But whereas that, you can't, it plays with, it's like Bridget Riley, it's optical illusion, isn't it? So it plays with your mind and you try and settle it in your mind and go, oh, that's what it is, and you can't quite work it out.
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to go back to saying about why it's kind of happened now, because it feels like a Photoshop thing, even though it's crafty, and there's such a rise in appreciation of craft and rediscovery of that, but yet your works are kind of Photoshoppy, which you would have manipulated on a computer, but you haven't.
No. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it's a mystery, really. I mean, the older I get and the more I do, oddly enough, the less I seem to know what it is I'm doing, which is nice. I like it.
I love that.
Me too.
That's quite freeing. Yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
And I think, in a way, it's about trying to find a relationship with images in which you're not in control of what's there.
Right.
I think the image is one of the deepest mysteries of our culture. What an image is. And yet we live in a culture in which that mystery is almost inaccessible. You can't feel that mystery any longer because of the ubiquity of images. We're completely surrounded by images. Images interface in every communication. And yet there is a deep mystery in what an image is. And it is an absence that you're confronting. When I see my son... on the phone to his girlfriend or whatever, and they're looking at one another on the phone or whatever.
FaceTime,
yeah. It's like she's there. It's not, and I keep saying to him, this is an image, Ben. You have to remember this is an image. And of course we don't. We've forgotten that this is an image.
Yeah.
My work, I think, is an attempt to try and hold on to that strange mystery of what an image is. before it vanishes completely and we're completely absorbed into the instrumentality of communications, which mm-hmm. I think is mostly what has happened to us, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And of course, cinema is the preeminent way in which we're drawn into an image from which we can never find a release, because in cinema you're constantly following an image. An image transforms into another. You can never grasp the totality of it. I think by collecting film stills, I am trying to find a way of becoming reflexively aware of things that you can never be reflexively aware of.
You're pausing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing.
Exactly.
And thank you for that. I mean, thank you so much for your work, because it has had such a big impact on so many people's lives. Mm-hmm. And I know it's going to be there for a long, long time. I think it's really important work. Mm-hmm. And I'm so happy that you're in Biennales now and you're showing all over the world, but also that the mainstream public are becoming to be aware of your work, you know, thanks to the work.
And through Talk Art.
Yeah. So talking about Talk Art, we ask every guest in each episode two questions. One is, if you could do an art heist and steal an artwork and take it home from a museum, not that I'm encouraging anything illegal here, but what would be your kind of touchstone that you would take home with you?
The thing I'd most like to remove from it, I think, I'm not sure which one, but it's probably a Giorgio de Chirico.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
You find that surprising? And actually, we're talking about Belgian symbolism before. Maybe a Delvo. I rather like Delvo.
Wow. I don't know that word, but I will look it up. We'll put that on the Instagram feed.
Yeah.
Good one.
Have you seen a specific Giorgio?
Let me think. There is one that's triangular, which has got a hand in it. Yeah. There are certain ones that really...
Right. Yeah. So he's of the same world as Magritte, right? Would you place him...
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the biggest influences within the Surrealist group on my work would be... Well, the first was Max Ernst. When I discovered Simone de Bonté as a student, I was just...
Blown away.
Yeah. And that's when I started making collages. It was just... I knew I had to follow that lead.
How old was you at that point?
18.
Wow. Yeah. 18. And you made your first collage at 18?
I was actually... It's not quite the story. Oddly enough, I was making them before I did that. But that gave me the... kind of
license to be like this is free. Yeah,
I was already cutting up my mother's shopping catalogue and doing paintings from these.
But she was curious about that.
No, they were the old ones.
Oh, okay, good. It didn't just arrive in the post. You're like, slice, 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 slice. Thank you.
And actually, I did want to mention that really quickly as a side, but I loved your canvas works. I remember going to a studio somewhere in East London to visit Jessie Flood Paddock, who's a sculptor, and she shared a kind of building that you had paintings in.
That's right.
And there were these screen prints on canvas, mm-hmm. which was so unexpected because I didn't even know you made that kind of work. But they were from the 70s, I think.
Some of them were, yeah.
Yeah, they were amazing. I loved those pieces.
Yeah.
I think Jake showed them as well a few times.
Jake at the Approach.
At the Approach Gallery, yeah. And then our other question we ask everybody is, what is your favourite colour? Which I'm quite interested to ask you.
Well, I was asked that recently by Interview magazine.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I knew instantly what the answer would be. Mm. It would be a kind of midnight blue.
A midnight blue, wow.
Because of the stars in the sky.
Yeah, I just love that colour. I tend to wear it, you'll notice.
Yeah.
I've worn that uniform for years. I think when I was young, my mother told me that I wanted to be either a policeman or a sailor. I think the reason was that both of them wore blue.
That's so funny. So you're attracted to the colour, yeah.
The colour and navy.
And actually, some of my favourite things you've done are often where you've got the astronomy lithographs or
Milky Way in the background.
And actually, we did those prints together, that's Father Sky and Mother Night, which is just about to come out with Counter Editions. But I love the way that you cut out the face of like the Western cowboy or whatever, and then you put in the clouds, or you put in the astronomy kind of journals. Yeah. It's so, so beautiful.
Yeah.
I was interested, though, that when I got the Interview magazine back, and they'd asked a lot of artists that, and it was something like three people chose Midnight Blue.
They did.
Oh, really?
And were they artists? They were artists.
All artists. Robert Longo was one. I can't remember who the other one was, no. But it seemed to be a general convergence on that.
Well, you're in good company.
Yeah.
Well, look, John, thank you so much
for
coming on.
Well, before we go, I've got something for you. I've got a present for you.
Oh, my God.
Now, this is something that means a lot to me.
Oh.
This is Bethesda Fountain in New York.
Wow.
And that's this postcard from 1908, and I've had it around my apartment. And Bethesda Fountain is my touchstone, one of my most favourite places in the world I go to. And I did a play called Angels in America a couple of years ago at the National Theatre. And the show itself was a huge influence and touchstone for me as an actor. Well, I found this postcard and I thought, well, who better to give it to than That's John so Stesica, nice. Hoping that at some point it will turn up on your work somewhere and then I will be able to get it back.
Well, maybe even better, I might be able to return it to you in a slightly modified form.
Exactly, yes. That would be amazing.
That would be the dream. But it's from, if you look at the back, it's like from 1908, yeah, and there's some woman, girls
writing
to her sister.
Actually, this is totally true because Russell's even taken me there. You, when we first went to New York together,
oh, yeah, I've got photos
about
3 years.
Years ago, yeah, or something, we've took photos,
yeah,
there.
I'm sure when I'm like 70, I'll have pictures of me every single year at Bethesda Fountain,
exactly,
with various,
yeah,
various, my dog and various boyfriends and friends over the years.
Well, look, John Stesica, thank you so much,
yeah,
for coming
so,
on. I hope
so
you enjoy
lovely.
Your present from Russell.
I do.
And
I
it's been amazing to spend time with you. Thank you so much.
Yes. Great pleasure.
And everyone, look at Instagram at TalkArt and you can see images of all the works we've been talking about today. Thank you very much. We will be back very soon.
Thank you. Love
thank
you, guys.
You, John.
Bye.
You've been listening to TalkArt with Robert Diamant and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at TalkArt, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Recorded at Spiritland London by Anthony Shaw and edited by Gareth Isles. Subscribe to TalkArt on iTunes and Spotify. Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.